No one can run from the past, but that won't stop Daisy from trying. With heartbreak behind her, she starts anew and crosses paths with a devoted firefighter and father who finds that she needs him more than anyone realizes. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. This week, we chase burning passion in A Firefighter's Ultimate Duty by Beverly Long. We're getting back into romantic suspense today, despite my better judgment. I really want this format to work, truly, so I'm giving it another shot with today's contender. I'm not exactly sure what drew me to this particular choice. I actually didn't expect to get back into suspense so soon, especially having been burned by both The Negotiator and Cold Case Colorado. But it was there in the new releases page, and it ended up in my virtual cart, and then it ended up in a box at my door, so here we are. Beverly Long, our author, has been at the writing game for a while, and her recent works all fall under the intrigue and suspense umbrellas, but it looks like she's also dabbled a little bit in paranormal romance with some time travel shenanigans. She introduces the book with a letter at the front, giving us a quick rundown about the characters who we are going to meet. And I'm going to guess that she was probably inspired by, recent events, since this book starts off a trilogy that surrounds first responders, and wanted to treat them like the heroes they are. The book is even dedicated to them. I suppose what got me curious about this book is that the hero in question was a firefighter, since when I think of a suspense novel, I'm thinking the hero would be some kind of law enforcement, if not government agent or private detective. So, given the fact that our hero does not fall into one of these categories, consider my curiosity caught. So let's dive in and get started with the cover. Like The Negotiator, it has that brushed border that I really like, though there isn't a grainy filter this time. Unlike a majority of the novels I've read so far, the hero is the only one featured on the cover, no heroine. However, on the back, we can see an illustration of a woman who we can guess should be Daisy. But back to the front, we have, well, a firefighter. He's standing in front of a fire truck, holding his helmet and wearing rescue gear, and looking slightly to the right with a concerned look on his face. It's exactly what I would expect from this particular imprint. I'm glad that they didn't try to add the heroine into the main shot, because the composition here is pretty airtight. Now we can dive right into those pages, and we begin with our hero, Blade. I really don't know what to do with this. Blade is the name of an edgy tweens OC, not a name I'd expect to find in a romance, let alone outside an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. And the amount of times my brain slipped and read Blaze instead of Blade was not helping. Honestly, I'm not sure if Blaze would have been a better choice per se, but it certainly would have added to my entertainment. Anyway, Blade Savick is a firefighter and paramedic in the small town on the West Washington coast called Nowhere. That is spelled as K-N-O-W-H-E-R-E. And I am already bracing myself for the name frenzy that the author is setting up. He's getting ready for his shift at the fire department, getting a download of the night's events from a coworker. Through this conversation and some inner dialogue, we learn that Blade is divorced, and he has a 16-year-old daughter named Raven. Okay. But before he can settle into his mourning, they get a call. There's an unconscious man who slipped on the mountainside, and they need to extract him from a ledge. Blade and his team waste no time in getting to the scene, where they find two people, a man lying prone on the ledge, and a woman who Blade assumed made the 911 call. And right out of the gate, we get the author's will throwing our two mains together. "There," Blade said, pointing across the way. About 20 feet in the air, on what appeared to be a narrow ledge, he could see a woman kneeling over a man's body. Her dark, shoulder-length hair swirled around her face in the 20-mile-an-hour winds. Maybe she heard them. Maybe sensed their arrival. But for whatever reason, she raised her face and turned to stare in their direction. And, as crazy as it seemed, Across the 200 yards that still separated them, he swore he felt a pull. On the one hand, I'm not really a fan of love at first sight. It doesn't make sense to me, mostly considering that I'm not sure how someone can feel an attraction to a person they haven't even spoken to yet. On the other hand, I get it. The Harlequins are short, bite-sized. There isn't a lot of room for the romance to blossom over time. And I can see the appeal of getting lost in a world where romance can happen at any moment, where fate has brought the two together, because, well, who wouldn't want that? But first, there is an emergency at hand. Blade and his team navigate a ladder to the two hikers, and after getting some information from the woman and adjusting positions as needed, Blade learns that his patient is something of a local celebrity, the owner of a sports store chain, and the woman who had called for help was a new employee on her very first day of work. Hosea Pratt, the fallen CEO, is lifted from the canyon, and Daisy Rambler gets her first introduction to life in Nowhere, Washington. She's got a completely new to-do list now, calling Hosea's wife, his assistant, the COO of the company, and needing to draft a press release describing what had happened. And she's feeling exhausted for more than one reason now. Not only was today her first day, but she and her 16-year-old daughter Sophie had just finished a 2-day drive from Denver. From the looks of things, it wasn't a lifestyle change that brought them out there, but Daisy, in fact, had been running from something. Luckily, she had a friend in the area who knew about the job at Pratt's Sports Spot as the marketing and public relations director, and helped to get things ready for Daisy and Sophie to land as softly as possible. Instead of being strung along in a mystery, we are given the potential threat right up front. Daisy had been running from a man named Jacob Posse, who could be charitably described as your basic stalker. Daisy believed that she's finally lost him forever, and she's ready to start again. In the midst of all the chaos of the morning, though, Daisy had lost a silk scarf, which Blade had picked up once he'd sent their patient along in an ambulance. Now he was agonizing on whether or not he should return it to Daisy. There were lost and found procedures, of course. He should follow them. But we all know he won't. As a firefighter, Blade had one 24-hour shift on and then 48 hours off, though he picked up hours when he was needed. As he came to the end of the shift that brought Daisy to his attention, he gets invited to breakfast from a friend of his, Marcus, a police officer. At breakfast, Blade and Marcus are also joined by Jamie, a doctor at the local hospital. Stepping outside of this moment, I'll note that the author wrote us a letter at the beginning of the book, and she's already named these three main characters for her trilogy, named Heroes of the Pacific Northwest. And it's brought my attention to a trend that I've noticed in romance novels. These little letters written to us before we begin a story, and more often than not, they tell us almost everything about the book, the characters we'll meet, and their trials. It's almost like that family member who writes everything about a Christmas present in the card, which ruins the surprise because you were taught to read the card before opening the present. But I suppose in romance, we aren't here for tension exactly. We all know how this will end, and maybe these little letters are tiny reassurances that everything will be okay, don't worry. But if we already knew that, would we need the little letters? I'm not sure, but it's an interesting trend, though, and I might have to teach myself to read the book before I read the author's note. Getting back to the boys and their breakfast, Marcus and Jamie tease Blade about his crush on Daisy, but Marcus is a good sport in the end and gives Blade Daisy's address so he can return the scarf. We should ignore the fact that Daisy is running from one stalker, and Blade got her address from his cop friend, and looks to be shaping up to become her new stalker. Also at breakfast, it's revealed that Blade is a chairperson for a fundraiser event. I am so thrilled to get to read about another fundraiser. It's known as the Spring Spectacular, an event meant to benefit the fire station. However, they don't have a corporate sponsor yet, so Blade's been having a little bit of a hard time. But resolved about Daisy, he finishes up breakfast and heads to her home. Daisy had been woken up that morning by her friend Jane, the one who had helped her escape Denver, and the two are surprised when Blade had shown up on her doorstep. Jane seems to give Blade her seal of approval and goes to leave, first wanting to say goodbye to Sophie. However, it's discovered that Sophie, resentful about the move, has flown the coop. The three adults quickly deduce that Sophie had grabbed her mom's credit card and car keys, and using a trip log that Daisy kept cross-referenced with her credit card activity, she was making the reverse version of their drive from Denver. Jane and Daisy were frantically trying to figure out if they could catch up to Sophie and be back in time for their respective jobs by Monday, but Blade had an idea. His friend Jamie, along with being an accomplished doctor, was also a pilot. He tells Daisy that he can ask Jamie to fly them to a point where they know Sophie would stop and wait for her. Daisy, left with few other options and encouraged by the fact Jane would have warned her against Blade if he wasn't trustworthy, agrees. True to his word, Blade gets Jamie to agree to flying them to the best estimated stopping point for Sophie, and they manage to get to a gas station just before Sophie pulls in to get gas. Having been cold to Blade after he offered her some unsolicited advice about dealing with Sophie, Daisy does manage to thank him, and she and Sophie can set themselves on driving back to nowhere, with Blade hitching a ride back to the airport to fly back with Jamie. Mother and daughter are able to reconcile on the way home, and it feels like a genuine conversation between a parent and their teenage runaway. Daisy is extremely forgiving, knowing full well that she's pretty much upended Sophie's life. However, now they can come to a better understanding, and they can start truly settling into their new home. The following Monday, after dropping Sophie off at school, Daisy has a full day at work. The big news is that Pratt's Sports Bot will become the main sponsor for the Spring Spectacular, and she will be the co-chair, alongside one of the firemen, none other than Blade Savick. Who could have foreseen this? To get the best event possible, Hosea has arranged for Daisy to shadow Blade at work. Because the event is a fundraiser for the fire department, it's important to impart what they do to potential event-goers. Something that I appreciate, as far as my reading tastes go, is that our couple hasn't completely launched themselves at each other the moment that they locked eyes. Looking back at episode 8 with the negotiator, the two mains were practically magnetized with the intensity of their attraction to the detriment of the situation, in my humble opinion. It's hard for me to get into a passionate romance when lives are at stake. But here with Blade and Daisy, we are maybe about a third into the story, and apart from Blade's initial Cupid bow strike, there hasn't been much in the romance department. And that's completely fine. Our mains are given the chance to get to know one another, and the suspense comes from Daisy's past. We aren't sure how it will play out yet, but so far it's a very low and slow burn. Hopefully things won't run completely off the rails. Daisy arrives at the fire station for her first day as Blade's shadow. She gets her first taste of firefighter life when she finds him fighting with the poorly equipped kitchen to make a pot of chili. Daisy offers to help, since Blade admits to being a rather terrible cook, and while they cook, they make plans for the event. They also thaw things out after Daisy had left things a little chilly between them. "Can we start fresh?" she asked. "I really want us to be friendly co-chairs." That wasn't quite what he'd been going for when he decided to return her scarf in person, but there was some water under the bridge now. "I'd like that," he said. He cocked his head and narrowed his eyes. "Assuming you haven't exaggerated your chili-making abilities." She picked up the large can of tomatoes that was on the counter. "Show me where the can opener is, and you can judge for yourself." It's very slice of life, and it seems to be a constant theme in the story. Just people living their lives, letting fate guide them as they go along. I'm not always down for the slice of life genre, but after mafia speakeasies, dull princesses, and hostage negotiations, it's a nice way to cleanse the palate, as it were. Continuing on that theme, that night Daisy and Sophie talk about her first day at school, and we get small tidbits of how their relationship is slowly repairing after Sophie's dramatic exit. Sophie has also met Blade's daughter Raven at school, as both girls seem to be interested in trying out for the play. I feel like readers who picked up suspense for the action might be bored with this, if not disappointed, but for me, these interactions are quite compelling. The next day, Blade gives Daisy a rundown of the gear that they use, as well as give her some to wear while she rides along with them for safety reasons. And it's easy to tell that the author has done her research on the day-to-day operations of a firehouse. Blade's knowledge comes off as authentic without being too clinical. There is a little bit of telling instead of showing when it comes to the choices that he makes while on a call, or descriptions of things that he uses, but that's not a bad thing here. For a layperson like myself, I enjoy getting that in-depth look of Blade's profession. And also, because Daisy is there to get information about firefighters, it works thematically as well. And of course, while Daisy is getting a rundown on how to wear the gear, we get a hint that things might at last heat up between them. "Let me help you," he said, stepping forward. He was close enough that she could smell the soap he'd used in the shower. It was a nice smell, reminding her that it had been a long time since she'd had the pleasure of smelling anything other than the lavender shower gel that she favored. She took a deep breath just as he reached for her right shoulder, realizing too late that as her chest expanded, it made it appear as if her breasts were just about to leap into his hands. She let out a puff of air, and like a nice guy, he pretended he hadn't noticed. But he was close enough that she could see his neck get red. It's just a small, even little cute moment that slips in. And I like that they try to get over themselves to move on. Blade drills Daisy on getting her gear on quickly when the bell rings, and it's time for action. Daisy will end up in the truck with everyone else on their way to a medical call. That's handled quickly, and they're only just back in the station when they're called out again, this time to a fire. Here is where the book starts to earn its place in the suspense imprint. The fire is in an old abandoned orphanage, but there were possibly people inside the dilapidated building. Daisy watches from the truck as Blade and his team get to work, running in to rescue whoever they can. Blade gets one man out, and then goes in for another in a real nail-biter of a scene. Blade and his patient get trapped well enough that he even starts to think about any regrets that he might have. But his team pulls through for him, battering out a wall to get them outside. Daisy practically faints when he finally emerged from the building. Later on, as she decompresses from the situation, Daisy starts to realize that Blade is giving her hope that she hadn't felt since she'd escaped Jacob, that there really were good men in the world. Both her and Blade are spending time on their own, apart, considering this budding relationship. I think it's really healthy that they're getting both physical and emotional space from each other. That way, they can take things step by step. Blade is obviously crushing hard, but he's not dumping his emotions all over Daisy, and they really haven't gotten together at all as a couple. I like that this time is being taken, and nothing is feeling forced. That night, Daisy returns home to find Blade's daughter Raven in her house. The two girls had met at school and had taken an interest in auditioning for the school play, like I'd mentioned before, so they were running lines together. It looks like the girls are getting along rather well. Not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but this is good news for our couple. Blade drops by to pick up Raven, and he brings in a gift basket that had been sitting on Daisy's porch. This gets her feelers up, but she does her best to keep from showing any concern in front of Blade and Raven. There's no card, but Blade says it looks like it came from a sweets shop in town, and recommends she check there to find out who sent it. The next day, after confirming that no one in her office had sent the basket, Daisy heads off to the store where it had come from, but unfortunately, the shop owner wasn't able to confirm much about the buyer other than a general description, a tall man with brown hair. The only thing about him that stood out was the fact that he was a stranger, which, outside of Nowhere's tourist season, was unusual. This does not offer the comfort that she had been hoping for. She got out of the store fast and then almost stumbled on a crack in the sidewalk because she turned her head so fast, trying to scan both directions. She ran to her car, got in, dropped her keys, snatched them up, and finally got the damn car started and in gear. She was three blocks down the road before she took a breath, and then it was big gulps, trying to flood her brain with oxygen. She definitely should not jump to conclusions. This paragraph, in my opinion, is great. We know that Daisy is on edge, but we don't know just how much until we get a scene where we experience a purely physical reaction. Like a cork on a champagne bottle, her nerves fly out of the gate, and she does her level best to get her emotions under control. We can see that Daisy is very scared. Back in Denver, she had been failed by the system that was meant to protect her, so now she was resolving to rely only on herself to protect her and her daughter. She doesn't want to raise any alarm here and nowhere, in case she wouldn't be believed. It's something of a sad moment, honestly. She can't trust people, either to help her or not to hurt her, so she feels helpless, unable to reach out. Back at work, she distracts herself with the social media theming for the upcoming fundraiser. She'd put out a call for folks to write in about their memories of the dance, which she was using to put together this year's event. There's cute little vignettes of local charm and display, and it really fleshes out the world that our characters are living in. Blade checks in with Daisy, hoping to understand why the basket bothered her so much, but no luck. Later, as he's discussing this with Marcus, he's determined to find out how severe a threat the brown-haired man posed to Daisy, and to get her to trust him with that information. Daisy continues to shadow Blade at his work, this time during hazmat training. After getting lots of pictures and whatnot, they'd start talking more, half about planning for the fundraiser, half about each other. They come to the topic of their past relationships, spurred on by the fact that, while picking up pastries for the firemen, Daisy had run into Blade's ex-wife. Blade asks her about Sophie's father, who had since died, and Daisy admits to having been recently engaged, but broke it off. She's close to telling Blade the whole story, but she doesn't fully trust him yet, and didn't want to potentially upend her life a second time. She leaves, agreeing to meet up with him at lunch to get started on a silent auction for the event. Said lunch is had at a local diner run by a woman named Gertie Biscuit. They tapped her to cater the event, so it was a good place to start their day and talk about the menu. While Blade and Daisy are eating, an odd moment pops up. They're talking about eggs and how they eat them. And Blade says something to the effect of not liking sunny-side-up eggs because he didn't like the way they looked up at him. This gives Daisy pause, because Jacob would eat his eggs sunny-side-up because he did like them looking at him. I have never heard sunny-side-up eggs described this way, and it feels a little strange to read the description. This moment just serves a purpose to remind Blade that Daisy is hiding something, and not doing a great job of it. But he lets it go. And after lunch, they talk to Gertie about the menu, who suggests they pick top favorites from the past years of the events, then to be voted on by the community. They begin their search for silent auction items at the mechanic garage run by Blade's parents. They meet his mom, who offers up free services as an auction item, and Blade gets tipped off that his dad isn't doing so well. At the end of the day, after having led Daisy around getting donations for the auction, he calls his father. It turns out his dad has stage 2 pancreatic cancer. Blade is rightly bummed by this, and when he talks to Daisy that evening, she offers to take him, Raven, and Sophie to the local ice cream parlor for some cheering up. After ice cream, they leave to their respective cars, but Daisy's doesn't start up. Blade comes over, tells her to leave the car keys with him so his mom can look at the car the next day, and drives Daisy and Sophie home. If that was all that happened, it would have just been an odd night with some car trouble. But when they roll up to Daisy's house, the door has been kicked in. Blade calls Marcus, who takes no time in showing up and sweeping the house with Blade. After they determine that there's no one inside, Marcus ushers them back in so that they can talk. And I am so happy that Daisy sees reason. I was afraid that she would keep the secret of her stalker, but she understands the severity of the situation and tells the whole story about Jacob, how she met him, how he charmed her, how he slowly ramped up his abuse. She eventually found out that everything he told her about his personal life was a lie, including the fact that he was actually leading a commune of about 15 people. She's done her best to separate from him, including getting a restraining order when he continued to stalk her, and eventually was pushed into running away, having to leave no trace behind her. Blade listens to her story, and does what we expect a romantic hero to do. Mentally, he's already thinking about dismembering Jacob, And when Daisy says she doesn't feel safe in the house, he insists on her staying with him at his place. And that's where I would expect everyone to go, yes, that is logical, even if a bit convenient, because this is a romance novel. Blade is presented to us as the ideal partner for Daisy, so we shouldn't doubt him or his motives. But something happens that I don't expect. Marcus all but grabs Blade and drags him to the kitchen to tell him to back off. Daisy is incredibly vulnerable right now, and the last thing she needs is another man telling her what to do and where to go. It's an incredible moment, and one we need to normalize. It is basically saying, men, women are scared of you. Please understand this, and don't push them into corners just because you like them. Marcus makes sure Blade understands that he needs to back up a bit, but Daisy is still comfortable accepting his offer to stay with him and Raven. Daisy is whirling, terrified that Jacob had indeed found her, and lamenting that she and Sophie would have to leave and start over again. The next morning, she and Blade talk about Jacob over coffee. My eyebrows go up when Blade declares that he'll personally stop Jacob, but it's probably his protective instincts flaring up. Daisy reveals to him that shortly before she left Jacob, she found news articles on his laptop, all describing cases where women were held captive for years, sometimes even in plain sight. Understandably, this frightened Daisy, but no one at the Denver police station would take her concern seriously. Overwhelmed with emotion, she begins to cry, and Blade takes her in his arms, reassuring her that he won't let anything happen to her, and they get swept up in the moment. Their faces were close, so close, and he leaned in and kissed her. And holy hell, she kissed him back, and it went on and on. A groan of pleasure, a gasp of joy, his, hers, sweet God in heaven, they were consuming one another. This is probably the most interesting kiss that I've read so far, and I have to say that I kinda like it. Unfortunately, Raven and Sophie have woken up and the lovebirds have to pull themselves apart. The sexual tension could be cut with a knife. After breakfast, Blade takes Daisy back to her car to get picked up with a tow truck and to evaluate what might be going on with it. They're met by his father, who encourages Daisy to try and run the engine over one more time. It catches immediately, shocking all of them. Blade tells his father that they have reason to believe that the car might have been tampered with, and his dad says that they'll take a look. After which, Blade takes Daisy grocery shopping, since he needs to get a few things, and they agree that they need to talk about what happened that morning. Once they've got all the groceries put away, and with the girls at play rehearsal, they sit down and communicate. Blade straight up apologizes, which is nice. It's good to see a guy take responsibility for his actions. He also says that he'll back it off if that's what Daisy wants. But it's not what Daisy wants. She looked at her watch. What time does play practice end?
2, he said, his voice suddenly hoarse.
She stood up. I prefer a bed over the couch. He practically vaulted out of his chair, and suddenly they were kissing again, and it was as good, every bit as good as before. His tongue was in her mouth, his hands were cupping her face, and their legs were intertwined.
A gentleman would ask you if you were sure, he said when he came up for air.
In response, she took his hand and led him down the hall to his big, comfortable bed. She sat on the bed and started to unbutton her shirt. Clearly, we have gone from 0 to 100 in a very short amount of time, but sometimes sexual tension is like that, and the both of them are very enthusiastic the entire time they are getting undressed. I'm expecting some explosive sex, but all we get is, well, a first, with Daisy beginning to go downtown, if you catch my drift. After that, it's your basic fade to black.
But both Daisy and Blade do seem relieved to be able to accept that they have feelings for one another, if only sexual attraction, and neither one wants to back down for the moment. They do hash out some of the nitty-gritty, though, mostly talking about who they should tell and when. They want to keep it close for now, and not surprise their daughters with the news just yet. They get a call from the garage, and Blade's mom tells them that there was evidence that the spark plugs in her car were tampered with, and it was possible that someone had made a copy of her key fob in order to get to the plugs. Of course, this continues to confirm Daisy's fear that Jacob had followed her to nowhere. Blade keeps Daisy calm, and from there, it's almost a slice-of-life montage of their time together. Blade takes all the girls to go shopping in Seattle, and after that, Daisy and Blade begin to finalize details for the Spring Spectacular dance. Even Sophie and Raven will help out by working with Gertie. Blade and Daisy also find time to talk about their relationship and how far they want to take it. Blade is ready to commit completely, but Daisy is understandably hesitant, and he doesn't push her. So the day of the Spring Spectacular finally arrives, and after three of these things in a row, I'm going to name the trope, Time for a Fundraiser! But everything is set. The venue, the food, the music, everything one could want for a small town shindig. And to make it even better, there hasn't been any signs of Jacob or any of his followers for 2 weeks. It looks like Daisy and Sophie can go back to their home soon, but first, the party. But this is where the suspense really shines. Daisy has been lured into a false sense of security, and we can start to think that nothing else will go wrong. But I've read enough suspense to know that today is the day everything goes pear-shaped. Daisy has a lot to get done today. She needs to make sure the last details are in place at the venue, visiting the salon, picking up menus from the printers, running the event. There are so many ways that, let's say, a stalker could just up and grab her. But she's not thinking that. However, during her errand runs, she takes a moment to stop at her desk at work, where she notices that her phone had 16 voicemail messages, every single one of them playing nothing but silence. Not wanting to wake Blade up after his shift, she calls Marcus, and thankfully he takes her seriously. He starts to work to figure out who it could have been leaving the messages, and Daisy can take comfort in his attention to the problem. After she gets her hair done for the dance, she heads to a sandwich shop. There, she sees a man she thinks she's seen before, but she couldn't be sure where. But he doesn't give her a long look at him, since the moment he sees her looking at him, he leaves the restaurant. She's trying to talk herself out of going completely paranoid and crazy when she sees the man meet up with a woman across the street. She doesn't think much more of it and moves on with her day. She makes it to the venue, ensures that everything is perfect, and the event gets underway without a hitch. Everything is perfect. What could possibly go wrong? Well, right about when dessert is going to be served, Daisy goes to the kitchen to check on Sophie and Raven, except no one's seen them. Gertie had gone to check on them, but she's been gone for a bit too. Daisy goes to the back alley door where they were all last seen, calling out for the girls. On the ground, she finds Gertie and hears a voice behind her. She turns around to see Jacob Posse, as well as the man and woman she'd seen at the sandwich shop. Those two have the girls, with guns in their hands. Jacob tells her that he'll let them go so long as Daisy goes with him. Daisy doesn't hesitate and agrees. Back at the party, Blade and Marcus realize that they haven't seen Daisy for a hot minute, so they go and check on her, right about the same time people in the kitchen have discovered Gertie. Blade has enough presence of mind to get into work mode to help stabilize Gertie until Jamie showed up, and Gertie could only tell Blade one word. Dumpster. He and Marcus run to the dumpster, where they find Sophie and Raven tied up but otherwise unharmed among the trash. Blade and Marcus get the full story from the girls, and the men spring into action. They theorized, based on what Daisy had told them about Jacob, that he was likely taking her to Iowa in a semi-truck, and now it was a race against the clock. First, Blade gets confirmation from Jamie that Gertie was stabilized well enough and everything that could be done for her had been done. He then asks Jamie if he could fly him across the potential route that Jacob would take.
Jamie agrees, and then Blade asks Marcus to cover any potential missed details back in town. With that, he runs to the airport where Jamie is preparing the plane. I enjoy the narrative bookends with the plane rescue. I wasn't expecting to see another flight, considering that Jamie isn't the focus character here. But I appreciate the fact that it's not just one guy against the villain, it's everyone coming together for Daisy's sake. Thankfully, the guys were dead on with their theory, and we see Daisy trapped in a truck with Jacob at the wheel. He is spouting all kinds of crazy, that they'll fall off the grid completely, and that she will give him children, specifically three sons. Out of self-preservation, she tells him what he wants to hear, but mentally preparing herself for the moment when he finally lets his guard down. After one failed search at a way station, Blade gets a lucky break from Marcus, saying that they were able to get a trace on Jacob's phone, thanks to the 16 calls left on Daisy's work phone. With that, they get a general location, and Jamie does something incredibly brave, if not stupid. He flies low over the road, close to mountains and trees, when they find a lone truck on the path. Then, Jamie flies ahead and parks the plane right on the road, far enough to set up flares and hope that the truck will stop before plowing into the aircraft. Blade will hide by the side of the road, in case Jacob recognizes him, and Jamie will stand by the plane. Daisy gets the shock of her life when Jacob stops and she sees Jamie by the plane, and she figures that Blade must be nearby as well. She doesn't move, though, lest she tips off Jacob. He leaves the cab, threatening her for good measure, and harasses Jamie about moving the plane. Jamie seems compliant, but Jacob decides that it's better to leave no witnesses. Right before he shoots Jamie, Blade charges into him and gets some good cathartic face beating in. Jamie stops him, and Blade runs over to Daisy, hugging her and proposing to her on the spot. She agrees to marry him, and they head home, beginning the process of melding their lives together. In the end, everyone is as happy as anyone could want. With that, we've come to the end of A Firefighter's Duty, and I'm very happy to have found it. With the last two forays of mystery slash suspense, I've been hoping to find a novel that balances the danger and the tension with romance, and I think I've finally found it with this book. However, there are still a few caveats that I want to mention. First of all, the names. I talked about it a bit in the beginning, but the names were wild. Our heroine on the run was Daisy Rambler. There's Blade and his daughter Raven. Jacob Posse ran a commune that was referred to in the book as his posse. Gertie's last name was Biscuit, and it was a well-known specialty of hers. And then there's this whole town called Nowhere. It's a lot. I have not seen such on-the-nose names except in My Little Pony. And this could be a related point, but I get the feeling that there wasn't much of an editing process when this book was written. Surely an editor would have sent a draft back with little notes asking if the names were really what we wanted to go with. And there were very exact descriptions that I felt weren't really necessary. We didn't need to know that there were exactly 7 cars in a parking lot. We didn't need to know that it was 9 steps to the kitchen. There are portions where the prose was tight and immersive, but it's paired with these clinical descriptions that drove me crazy. But what really got my feelers up was one passage where Blade was talking to Raven and the narration slipped and called her Sophie. If there's anything that will drag me out of a story like I've been dropped into a vat of ice-cold water, it's a glaring error like that. And I feel awful for the author. I mean, I understand the writing process, and I'm willing to forgive some mistakes. I know what it's like to read your writing over and over. Words lose meaning, characters blend into one another, prose gets worked into a knotty mess. That's why it's so important to have an outside editor review your work, or even get a copy editor at the very least. So I'm willing to forgive the author for a mistake of misattributing a character's name, but I'm pretty upset with the editor, if there was one at all. If there wasn't, this story deserved one, and it could have been elevated beyond what the final draft looked like. But with all that aside, let's look at Heather's final score. As always, we start with the cover,
which will get a 4 out of 5. It's an airtight composition, again setting the appropriate tone with a concerned firefighter, but unfortunately, it loses points because there's no Daisy. It's a romance, after all. It was an excellent execution, don't get me wrong, but I would have liked to see the leading lady. Drama gets a 4 out of 5. The story starts slow, and while we all know that Daisy's stalker would play a part in the end, we get to watch Daisy slowly become unsettled with every incident that brings Jacob closer to her. Blade gets his fair share of drama as well, the burning orphanage being the best example. Daisy also doesn't yank us around by trying to hide things when it got serious. It's a solid foundation, and I found it quite enjoyable. Romance gets a 5 out of 5. Like I said, it was a slow burn, and I found the attraction between Blade and Daisy authentic and genuine. They took time to get to know one another, and when they got together, their chemistry was absolutely believable. Realism will get a 4 out of 5. The author took great care in describing everything from Blade's job to the small town that I felt like I could take a fall trip to nowhere this year if I wanted. Even the plain shenanigans didn't yank me out of the story, only because I've got a good baseline for what a small town airport would look like and how those planes operate. The only thing that brings the realism score down is the climax, simply for the fact that the firefighter went on the rescue instead of the cop, but not because the woman got kidnapped and needed rescue. I mean, come on. I'm into the damsel in distress plot. This is my jam. So, in all, I think that a firefighter's ultimate duty is an excellent addition to your romance shelf. If you're into firefighters and suspense, I highly recommend this read. I was practically ready to stick this on the gold star shelf, but unfortunately, I can't abide by the bad editing. For my final score, A Firefighter's Ultimate Duty gets 4 Crazy Plane Rescues out of 5. Thank you so much for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or just want to say hi, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hyun Cho, and Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.